From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. There's a legal doctrine known as qualified immunity. During a recent trip to Raleigh, a libertarian legal expert explained why he's fighting it. You'll learn details. North Carolina's innovative school district continues to generate controversy. You'll hear state senators debate the latest plan to tweak that district for low-performing schools. The effort to enact criminal law reform in North Carolina gets a high-profile endorsement from the former Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court. And speaking of courts, we'll ask whether the American Bar Association should continue to play a role in judging potential judges. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
For nearly five decades, education organization Phi Delta Kappa has asked a random national sample of adults to identify the biggest problem facing public schools in their community. Our next guest has been looking back at those results and how the issues have varied over the years and what folks seem to have settled on for the last few. Dr. Terry Stoops is Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies at the John Locke Foundation. He joins us now. Okay, Terry, 50 years is a long time. Mm-hmm. Now, presumably, people's views would have changed. Give us a sense of some of the issues that have plagued people's concerns over the last few years.
Sure. One of the things that parents are really concerned about, and they continue to be concerned about, but in various times they seem to have more of a focus on school safety, student behavior, and those sorts of issues, looking about what happens inside the classroom and thinking about how that affects the overall educational process.
So disruptive kids, maybe their kids are being bullied, mm-hmm. things like that.
That's right. And one thing to note about this poll question in particular is they leave it wide open. So a parent doesn't have a list of things that they can choose from. They basically come up with an answer on their own. And Phi Delta Kappa, they take the answer and they look at it and categorize it into various categories like student safety or student behavior or the issue that was big in the 1980s, which was drugs. There was a
Really?
Belief that parents believed that drugs were the biggest problem in school. And there were and continue to be problems with drugs. I don't know if anyone would necessarily say now or even then that it was the biggest problem, but that was the perception that parents had, that drugs were the biggest problem. And at various times, other issues will creep in. Certainly, school funding has been something that in various years has taken hold of what parents believe is the biggest problem, and other issues that seem to be really dependent on the news of the day.
That is a very interesting point because those of us who lived through the 80s, and you and I think, fit that category, we remember that the Reagan administration had a very big push to talk about kids and saying no to drugs, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That was widely in the media for a very long time. You kind of have to wonder if maybe that impacted what people were thinking was going on in schools.
Yeah, I really think that it did. And when you look at the period in which parents answered that question, it really did coincide with that campaign, the Reagan administration, the beginning of the George Bush administration. So the timing seemed to be right with that. And I also believe that in the 70s, when parents were saying that student misbehavior was the issue, that there were also some things going on with that. There were changes to the way that schools treated student misbehavior. They became much more cautious. they were less willing to do corporal punishment. And so there was a perception that students were getting away with behaviors that in previous years, especially in the 50s and 60s, would not have been tolerated. So there definitely is a perception. There was a perception, especially in the 1970s, when it was the one thing chosen by parents as the biggest problem, that schools had become lax in their disciplinary policies.
You write about this in your Carolina Journal column, and of course that's available at carolinajournal.com, that over the past few years, and not quite a couple of decades, that the issue of funding and money has really come to the top of the list. Is that because of media coverage?
I really think it is, and it for the last 18 years that has been at the top of the list, and through the 90s, a couple times in the 90s, it reached the top. Now, when I say the top of the list, it's not as if 80% chose funding. Because it's a wide open question, only 25% of the respondents chose funding as the biggest problem, but it was by far the highest one. It had the plurality. So parents choose that. They interview teachers as well. Teachers overwhelmingly choose that as their top issue. And I really do believe that that is a factor. I think there's been a concerted effort, especially in the media, to highlight issues of schools supposedly not having the kind of funding that they need. All the press about teachers buying their own supplies plays into that. When teachers have to buy things for the classroom, parents assume that they do that because the school doesn't have enough money. So all of these things combine to create the perception that there's a money problem in schools, and that really is the biggest problem. And by connection to that problem, the way to solve schools' problem is to increase its funding.
Are the survey respondents, Terry, perhaps equating more money equals more learning?
I believe so. And, you know, the connection is made in various ways. You know, some people believe that if schools had more money, they'd be able to lower class size or provide specialized programs or hire more teachers. I don't know if they necessarily make that connection. But the one thing that I've noticed about a lot of parents is it's an easy answer. It's an answer that's not complex. There's a public policy way to go about solving the problem. You know, a lot of people say that the biggest problem that schools face is students' poverty, their parental, their home life. There's really no easy way to solve that problem. And so rather than having to take on those issues, which are very difficult, they just say more money. That's easy. How does that happen? The legislature, Congress spends more money on public schools. And so that's an easy out for parents. It's an easy logical connection for them to make. But I don't think it really gets to the heart of the challenges that schools face or would be the magic bullet in raising student achievement.
What does the research say about the connection between how much money you spend and how well kids are doing in school?
Well, it's really mixed. There was several decades of research that said that there wasn't much of a connection. Some very recent research says that there might be a connection. But here's the twist with some of that research that's coming out. And it's an empirical research that simply looks at test scores as compared to money spent. We don't know how this money was spent. We know that the states, school districts spent more money. We don't know how they spent it. So if we're looking for a public policy solution, spending – just throwing more money at schools sometimes may work, but we can't really tell how it was spent. And that's the one thing I think we need to focus on in this whole debate about whether we should spend more money on schools is that – you can throw more money at schools and spend it terribly and it not have any effect on student achievement. Or you can spend that money wisely in ways and research-based ways that raise student achievement. How you spend the money is a critical component in thinking about the relationship between school finance and student performance.
Well, how should we spend the money? What should the focus be then?
Well, the one way that I think that we need to go about it is thinking about how we can recruit better teachers to the profession and keep our great teachers in the classroom. So often teachers find that the only way to get a raise is to become a school administrator. I would like to see us give these teachers additional funds so that they can stay in the classroom and continue to be great teachers. That's one way I think we can effectively spend money. There are other ways that we can improve student achievement, I believe, without spending another dime, and that's to open up school choice to as many students as possible. If we can tailor their education to their needs, which is what school choice does, then we have a better chance of them performing well on state tests and doing well in life.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. When I say the words qualified immunity doctrine, there's a good chance many of you have no idea what I'm talking about. It's also the type of phrase that might help put non-lawyers to sleep. Well, our next guest is here to tell us why we should know what that term means and why it's important to get rid of it. Clark Neely is Vice President for Criminal Justice at the Libertarian Cato Institute. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what is this qualified immunity doctrine? Why is it so important?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. It's something probably a lot of people don't know about, but they should. A hugely important question when we clothe public officials with tremendous authority and discretion, as we do, particularly when it comes to members of law enforcement, police and prosecutors, is what kind of accountability comes along with that. And there are only so many ways that you can hold people who wield that tremendous power accountable. One way is through the criminal justice system, so they can be prosecuted, for example, if they violate somebody's rights in a way that's actually a crime. That's quite unusual and not normally how you'd want to, you wouldn't want that to be your sort of first line resort. The other possibility is internal accountability mechanisms. So we're talking about sort of internal affairs or review boards or things. And for a variety of reasons we can get into or not, those have proven to be largely ineffective. So that really leaves private lawsuits, civil liability, so that, for example, if your rights have been violated or you believe your rights have been violated by a government official, including particularly a police officer, then you have the ability to take that person to court and get a ruling that determines that your rights have been violated and whether you're entitled to any sort of compensation. Qualified immunity essentially disrupts that process by making it virtually impossible to hold police and other government officials accountable in court for their rights violations. And the way it does that is essentially what it does is the Supreme Court has inserted two words into the federal civil rights statute. There's a federal civil rights law that's been on the books for more than 100 years, and it says that government officials shall be liable to anyone that they injure for the deprivation of any right. The Supreme Court has changed that law, in effect, by inserting the words clearly established between any and right. So now you can only sue a police officer or other government official for violating a clearly established constitutional right of yours or any other kind of right. It has to be clearly established. Well, what does that mean? Well, what it means is that unless you can find a case that already where that has already happened, whatever it is they did to you has already been done and a court has said that's not permissible, that is a violation of that person's rights, then the right is not clearly established and your suit will be dismissed. And this is usually problematic because it has basically caused the law to stagnate. We don't get sort of new rulings from courts saying what is okay and what isn't. And we can get into some examples in a moment. And what it has done is it's really disrupted the feedback loop so that police officers and other government officials are not getting accurate feedback from the public anymore about what we expect of them when it comes to use of force and other issues involving our rights.
We're speaking with Clark Neely. He is vice president for criminal justice at the Libertarian Cato Institute, which is leading a judicial and legislative effort to repeal this qualified immunity doctrine. You mentioned examples. Some people probably got a gist of what you were talking about, but how does this play out in the real world?
Sure. I can give you a couple of examples of cases that are on their way to the Supreme Court right now. We don't know whether the court will take these cases, but it gives you an illustration of you know, the context in which this can come up. One involved a lawsuit by a woman who was swimming in a public swimming pool in Nebraska. She was horsing around with her family and her boyfriend, and someone mistook what was going on, was afraid that she was being attacked, so they called the police. The police showed up and asked to speak with her. She spoke with them and assured them that there was no problem. She wasn't, you know, being attacked or anything. During that conversation, she looked over and noticed that somebody was hassling one of her children. So she said to the officer, "I need to go and help my child, but I'll come back and finish speaking with you after I've done that." And he said, "No, you need to stay and speak with me." Now, keep in mind, she wasn't understood to be the perpetrator. She's supposedly the victim. And she's about 5'2", 110 pounds in a bathing suit, not armed. So she says, "I will speak with you, but I need to go talk to my child first." And so she turns and walks away. He comes up behind her. The police officer comes up behind her, gets her in a bear hug, lifts her up off the ground, turns her upside down, and drives her onto her head so hard that he knocks her unconscious and breaks her shoulder. She sued for excessive use of force, and the Federal Court of Appeals, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, held that the police officer was entitled to qualified immunity, meaning the case could not go forward. Why? Because there wasn't a case on point where a police officer had picked up a petite woman unarmed who was not resisting, turned her upside down, and drove her onto her head. That is an example of what qualified immunity does in our system, is it allows police officers who have very obviously violated somebody's rights to escape liability, to escape accountability, in effect, for that. And I could sit here, unfortunately, all day and give examples like that.
Now, you're a lawyer. I'm not. So I'm going to ask if I get this sense correctly, because this is something that you said the Supreme Court established, a Supreme Court could then unestablish it or disestablish it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Qualified immunity purports to be an interpretation of a federal statute. It's not a constitutional doctrine. So there's actually two potential paths to getting rid of it. One is for the Supreme Court to go back and reconsider the cases in which it just created this doctrine from whole cloth. And we should emphasize that for a moment. This purports to be an interpretation of a congressionally enacted statute, but it's not. This was just an exercise in judicial creative writing. They literally made this get out of responsibility free doctrine made it up out of whole cloth. So that is one route. The Supreme Court could reconsider those precedents, overrule them, and eliminate qualified immunity that way. The other possibility, and as you mentioned, we're working along these lines as well, is for Congress to amend the law to clarify that amend federal civil rights law to clarify that qualified immunity is not a defense that is available to government officials under this law. So either way, either of those are viable, and it would be, I think, really desirable to eliminate this qualified immunity doctrine because, as I said before, it's disrupting a vital feedback loop between the public and government officials about what we expect from them when it comes to respecting our rights.
This doesn't sound like it has to be a left-right, pro-Trump, anti-Trump, one of these black or white issues. Everyone ought to get involved and see that this is the way to go, right?
I think it's right. So first of all, we have the question of whether this is a legitimate policy. In other words, whether you think it's a good idea or not, is it legitimate for the Supreme Court to engage in policymaking and essentially say, well, you know, this law does provide liability for the deprivation of any right, but that's not really a very good idea. We need to give police and other government officials a little more leeway in doing their job. You could certainly argue for that as a policy, but it's not the policy that Congress enacted. The Supreme Court simply invented it out of whole cloth. So that's point one. And if you're an originalist, conservative, textualist type of justice, then you should be inclined to get rid of qualified immunity because it doesn't have a shred of originalist, historical, or textual legitimacy. On the other end of the spectrum, if you're sort of a left-leaning type of person, they tend to focus more on individual injustices. And qualified immunity is an astonishingly unjust policy, and it generates a tremendous amount of injustice. And that would be another reason to get rid of it. Just on policy grounds, is it doing what we want it to do? It is absolutely not. It's actually perpetrating a great deal of injustice.
In the brief time that we have left, is this likely to change anytime soon?
It's always in trying to assess the likelihood of getting rid of any government favoring doctrine. You're always starting off somewhere around the 10-yard line, I would say, not the 50. But if I had to pick one really pernicious, kind of legal doctrine that there's a decent chance of getting rid of it, I think this is the one, and I'd say we're better than 50-50.
Once again, it's called the Qualified Immunity Doctrine, and one of the people working to get it overturned by hook or by crook, judicially or legislatively, is Clark Neely, Vice President for Criminal Justice at the Libertarian Cato Institute. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State lawmakers continue to debate the future of the innovative school district. That's a reform designed to help improve North Carolina's lowest performing public schools. The district, also called ISD, continues to draw opposition from Democrats like State Senator Jay Chaudhary.
I believe that there still remains very little evidence that such innovative school districts work. As many of you know, under the innovative school districts, the Department of Public Instruction would take over a low-performing school district and contract it with a privately managed operator. And for the last 3 years, the track record, both in other states and now here, is one that receives a failing grade. In other states, the evidence overwhelmingly suggests that such districts have not worked. In Tennessee, for example, a similar program called the Achievement School District has been in existence for 6 years. And according to a study that came out earlier this year, these districts have not resulted in any improvements in student achievements for the first 6 years. As a professor there who studied the district said, we feel confident at this point that the strategy followed for achievement school districts hasn't produced positive results for students we'd hope to see. And in fact, in Tennessee, the Tennessee Education Commissioner has said that there is a need to rethink this approach.
On the other side of the fence, Republican Senator Rick Horner urges colleagues to support reforms. They're designed to make the innovative school district work better.
I'm not going to argue with the success or lack of success of the programs. That's the reason for this bill here. I say to put bubble gum on this thing, try to fix it. But if we fail to pass this bill, four schools automatically go into a system Senator Chaudhry has said doesn't work very well. I mean, that's current law. If we do nothing, four schools will be added to the ISD program. So I believe this is a good attempt to salvage the program and give us time to see if it's something viable we want to do. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. But they're trying, and you got to try in the public school universe. You got to do something for kids that, particularly this one, that don't have an option for a charter school or an in-district school option within their district. There's nowhere else they can go. I mean, and you can just say, well, just tough luck. At least this is a try, and it's not working very well right now. Granted. But vote against it, and you condemn four more into going into something you're saying it's not working. That makes no sense to me.
That's Republican State Senator Rick Horner responding to Democratic Senator Jay Chaudhry. They're debating the future of a public education reform dubbed the Innovative School District. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. As North Carolina policymakers move forward with criminal law reform, they're getting a high-profile endorsement. Former State Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Martin touted the issue during a recent summit in Raleigh.
If you wanted to destroy a legal system, what would you do? Well, you'd make the rules so ambiguous, confusing, and extensive that virtually every entity, every person, is in a perpetual state of noncompliance. Does anybody here actually know every law that we have in this state? Every ordinance? Absolutely not. And, you know, as one of the numerous attorneys in the room, we understand that we are heading to a world of what? Greater and greater specialization. Why? Because it's impossible for an attorney to master every silo, every area of the law. And that's why this is a conversation that we definitely need to have as a society. I don't think anyone would say we're here yet, right? But how do we take steps to simplify, to really make the idea of a social contract meaningful, where people understand the law, have fair notice, and so can actually comport their actions, their planning, to the constraints of the law?
Martin asked whether too many laws affect business.
Have we criminalized business? Well, an article from The Economist talks about how I think we would all agree with the normative proposition that companies should be held accountable. But in the words of The Economist, are there times when it becomes extortion? We've all heard the stories of entire industries being shut down and then reopening in China. What does that do for the American worker, for the American economy? Consider the criminal verdicts imposed on U.S. executives in many cases. So it's certainly some thoughts that we need to have about how we hold business accountable in a way that also allows us to be a meaningful participant in the global economy.
Martin suggests too many laws can affect politics as well.
What about politics? Have we criminalized politics to some degree? The Ted Stevens case is a real interesting one because a federal judge actually dug deep after the fact and realized that prosecutors had broken multiple rules in the investigation and prosecution of Ted Stevens. But this is not does not stand alone. And many of us would say, what's happened to civility in our society? What's happened to professionalism? And we know in at least a few cases what's happened to good faith prosecutions. So add to Ted Stevens, former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. According to an article by Josh Stiltz, prior to the Supreme Court's ruling in Skilling, the honest services provision was broadly enforced. And I think all would agree, at times in a very amorphous way. And political officials weren't exactly sure where the lines would be drawn. And I remember when I was Chief Justice talking to several Chief Justices who said they had stopped going to educational programs like this and with legal organizations for fear that someone might take issue with a free lunch, even when there was an educational program attached to it. And I don't think that's a place we want to get as a society, where everybody is hiding in their silos for fear of what happens if they come out of the silo and actually meaningfully engage with other stakeholders.
That's the voice of former North Carolina Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Martin, featured speaker at a recent summit on criminal law reform. He pointed to one of the most absurd examples of overcriminalization.
Maybe this is the ultimate example. The lemonade stand. I guess I should go ahead and confess that I'm guilty here. As a child, I operated a lemonade stand. I didn't have a business license. The stand had not been inspected, right? And so you need to know that three girls in Georgia were busted by their local police chief for running an illegal lemonade stand. When they were asked why they did it, they said, well, we were simply trying to save up money for water park tickets. In Oregon, a lemonade stand was shut down. In this case, it was a 7-year-old girl because Portland authorities said the girl did not have a business license and her stand had not been inspected. And last but not least, the parents of kids in Maryland were slapped with a $500 fine for allowing their children to operate a lemonade stand. So again, I'm just trying to get us to think outside the box. Are we where we want to be in terms of the degree of criminalization and regulatory overreach in our society?
What happens when prosecutors have a great deal of discretion in dealing with violations of the law?
We know that prosecutorial discretion is an integral part of our criminal justice system, but we also know another important characteristic or quality is uniformity of application and uniformity of outcomes. One thing we do know is that unchecked discretion holds great potential for injustice. I always like Ken Davis's quote, and so I'll read it. Where discretionary power is exercised, it ought to be confined, structured, and checked in order to achieve the greatest amount of discretionary justice and the least amount of discretionary injustice. Unconfined, unstructured, and unchecked discretion holds great potential for injustice.
Martin took a step back to ask a more basic question.
So what are our primary goals? Well, first we know that the criminal law deprives an individual of life, liberty, or property. So why do we allow this? We first understand that the community, as a group, decides on matters that are so unacceptable that there has to be a criminal sanction attached to it. And so we consider this the moral condemnation of the community. We also want to deter conduct to preserve order and protect the public. I think Professor Henry Hart said it well. We have to have a formal and solemn pronouncement of the moral condemnation of the community. And those are the matters that should be a part of the criminal justice system.
The former Chief Justice expects no easy answers to questions about overcriminalization.
The reality is, this is an area where it is difficult at times to strike the balance. We clearly have the interest of the public, if you view it here in this triangle, in safety, public safety, safety of the community. We also have constitutional burdens that are imposed on this state to make it hard to successfully prosecute and obtain a conviction in a criminal case. And then finally, we have the liberty interest of the individual.
It might be hard to strike the right balance in criminal law, but Martin pointed to the problems linked to having either too few or too many laws.
Where does undercriminalization leave us? Well, undercriminalization fails to protect the public from wrongdoers, fails to deter individuals from public mischief or the destruction of the order of peace of society. And that actually goes back to Blackstone. On the other hand, where we have overcriminalization, we still protect the public, right? At least in a sense. But we fail to protect individuals from the state. Oftentimes, we convert innocent citizens into wrongdoers because they are not even aware of the standards that they'll be held accountable to. And finally, it erodes trust. If you overcriminalize and the public no longer understands what's off limits, it has a chilling impact on liberty, has a chilling impact on formation of for-profit companies, nonprofit initiatives, a lot of the good that comes out of society where people know that it's okay to move forward on something.
That's former North Carolina Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Martin, featured speaker at a recent forum on criminal law reform. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The American Bar Association has enjoyed a positive reputation in this country for decades, but based on its recent evaluation of Lawrence Van Dyke as unqualified for a seat on the Court of Appeals, the John Locke Foundation's Director of Legal Studies says the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee should no longer look to the ABA for guidance on these nominations and nominees. John Guzet joins me now to talk about all this. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
You write that Lawrence Van Dyke just got the Kavanaugh treatment. What
right.
do you mean by that?
Well, much as they did with Brett Kavanaugh, the left has decided to sink this nomination not by pointing out specific things about the candidate that might make him unqualified, but simply through a process of character assassination. It's a high-tech lynching, as Clarence Thomas said when they tried to do it to him years ago.
Tell us about Lawrence Van Dyke. What is his background and what was he nominated for?
He was President Trump nominated him to join the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Prior to that, he'd been Attorney General for Montana, and prior to that, I think he was an Assistant Attorney General in New Mexico. He had a very distinguished career. He also ended up, I think, as prosecutor for the Department of Justice. So he has a thoroughly impressive background. He also went to Harvard Law School, where he graduated magna cum laude. He was the editor of the Harvard Law Review, which is the most highly regarded law journal in the country, by any objective measure, he was clearly very well qualified for this position.
When the president makes a nomination to a consequential seat like this, there is presumably a vetting process. People, different organizations weigh in on the nominee. And the American Bar Association has always, by my read, been considered kind of the gold standard. What does the ABA think about a person's background, history, qualifications, et cetera? What did the ABA say about Lawrence Van Dyke and why?
They submitted a letter saying they had decided to rate him unqualified and not for anything to do with his professional behavior in his various offices, but simply because some of the people they interviewed described him using phrases like arrogant, lazy, had a privileged attitude. They said these kinds of things about him.
Well, presumably there would have been other people who said something different about him?
Absolutely. After the letter was published, a great many of the people, including many who were interviewed by the ABA for this appointment, came forward saying that they had given him a glowing review, and they described him as hardworking, thoroughly knowledgeable, fair, a pleasure to work with. So they gave a very one-sided account of what was reported, and they didn't give any specifics. I mean, they didn't say something he'd done that was inappropriate, or they didn't. It was just a hit job.
What kind of an impact has this unqualified rating by the ABA had on his nomination?
Well, I don't think it's going to hurt his nomination at all. But in fact, what the people who were really suffered as a result of this is going to be the ABA. What this after the letter was published. A great many ABA members, some of them resigned. Some of them came forward and said, I'm no longer going to appear at ABA functions. Many of them called for – well, Josh Blackman, for one, said he's a law professor who came forward and said he thought that the lady who interviewed or who ran this whole vetting process for Van Dyke ought to get called before the Senate committee and have to testify under oath about how she could have been so unfair. So I think the people who really lost from this is the ABA itself, and many people are now saying – myself included, that they probably shouldn't be consulted any longer about judicial nominees because they simply can't be objective, or they won't be objective.
Did Mr. Van Dyke respond to any of this?
He was asked about some of these allegations, one in particular during the hearings. One of the nastiest things in the letter was the way it distorted his response to a standard question. The letter said that he had refused to say he could be objective to members of the lesbian, gay, and transsexual community. But in fact, what had happened was they'd asked him that question, will you be fair to these people? And he had responded in the way all judicial candidates respond by saying, I will be fair and objective to everybody. And at the hearing, he practically broke down into tears when this came up because as a Christian, he said, I think that all human beings are created in God's image and they should all be treated with respect and equal dignity. So this was just a disgraceful way to treat somebody who's been nominated to sit on a federal bench.
John, if you believe, and as you've mentioned, others apparently do as well, that the ABA is no longer able to be objective about these nominees, then to whom should the Senate Judiciary Committee turn to try to understand who a nominee is?
Well, I don't actually know of any organization that would win the confidence of both the left and the right on these kinds of judicial nominations. So probably the best thing is for them simply to do their own research, make their own inquiries, and make their own best judgment based on what they find. Personally, I have confidence in the Federal Society. They do a great job of evaluating potential judicial candidates, and so does the president. He's relied on them throughout his term. But I'm sure the left would never go along with that. So I think the Senate's just going to have to do this on their own going forward.
You know, John, over the last several decades, as we have watched this nomination process and these public hearings, it has gotten really, really ugly, I think, fair to say. What has happened to us? And it didn't used to be like this.
No, it didn't. And it really started with the nomination of Robert Bork. They call it Borking back then because the idea was if you can find some dirt on a candidate or say enough nasty things, his nomination will be withdrawn. Now, that worked with him, and it worked with Judge Ginsburg, but it hasn't worked really very well since then. I mean, Clarence Thomas, they tried to sink him this way, and he went ahead and was appointed to the court. And they tried to do it most recently with Brett Kavanaugh, and that really backfired too. The problem, I think, now is that it's just become the Democrats and the left's go-to plan. Whenever they don't like somebody or they want to stop them from speaking, they just smear them in the public media and hope that they'll go away. I wish that would change. It doesn't seem the right way for us to be trying to resolve any of our disputes.
Wasn't the standard that was previously used by members of the Senate who were making these votes really whether the person was qualified or unqualified, not really the ideology or the potential politics or evidence of politics of that person? It was really based on whether they were a qualified jurist?
Sure. I mean, previous candidates, some of whom have pretty extreme ideological views, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Antonin Scalia, these were people who were approved almost unanimously by the Senate. So this is a new phenomenon. It doesn't have to be this way. In fact, recently, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was interviewed about this, and she said, and I think I'm quoting this correctly, the way it was right, and the way it is wrong. So nobody likes it, but it's not clear what we can do about it.
And, of course, the Supreme Court Justice Ginsburg was very good friends with the late Justice Scalia, and those two people could not be any further apart in terms of their views of the Constitution, et cetera.
Probably not. And they set an example that a lot more people should be following today. We don't have to hate each other just because we disagree about things, and we certainly shouldn't try to shut one another up by using personal smears. It's just not the right way.
John Guzet is the Director of Legal Studies for the John Locke Foundation. John, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.